Lord Buddha has many level of disciples. Some are very simple, some are very intelligent, some are not very intelligent, some have a lot of merits, some have imprints from previous Buddhas before him that are ready to open up now to his teachings. Some are very new. Some in this life, even hearing the teachings, will not make a difference in their life. So Lord Buddha, during his time, have many, many level of students. They have to understand, they go into hundreds of thousands. And some of the students are not human. They belong to the Naga world, or the spirit world, or the realm of gods that we cannot see. So he has many, many level of students. Some already have practiced with previous Buddhas to a very high level. Some are just stepping up. So if Buddha was to give a teaching, one teaching, it would not suit these people. If he was to give these teachings, it would not suit these people. If he gave these teachings, it would not suit these people. So therefore, he had to give different level and different class of teachings to help the different types of students and beings that came to him, human and non-human. And sometimes, Buddha had to be in two or three or four places at the same time. So the Buddha has three different types of bodies. He has a normal human body, he has an enjoyment body, and he has an ultimate body. He has three Buddhas, so don't be concerned about that. Three bodies, don't be concerned about that. So therefore, because he has the power of the three types of bodies, they're called gayas, he can multiply his body in many, many places. Because he can multiply his body in many, many places, his body can teach simultaneously to different students at different times. So the bodies that the Buddha emanated are not puppets. So if he's in South India, in Central India, and North India teaching, if he's actually in North India, but he's emanated two bodies in Central and South India, he doesn't have to control and tell them what to do. They operate on their own. Because why? It's his own emanation of his own enlightened mind. So therefore, the teachings here can be taught on one level, the teachings here can be taught on another level, and the teachings here can be taught on another level. And simultaneously, his body can be in the God realm to teach another level. It can be simultaneous. So the Kala Chakra teachings are one set of teachings that belong to the highest level of teachings that Buddha taught to very advanced disciples. Disciples who are ready. Therefore, these Kala Chakra teachings are a set of teachings associated with the Kala Chakra deity that help us to transform our anger, our desire, and our hatred into Buddha nature. So what happens was, when he taught these teachings, everybody who practices the Kala Chakra teachings, some will become a Buddha in one life, some a few lifetimes, some cannot, some will. Some even practice, they go to worse places because they actually don't practice, but they pretend they are. So what happens is this, is that for these people who practice very hard, there's a special place that they can be reborn in. This place is a place that you can only see, hear, taste, and touch only by karmic affinity. Example, in Chinese, some people have the third eye, they can see spirits. There are spirits in this room right now. Some of us can see, some of us cannot. I know people who, even they don't want this kind of ability, but they have the ability, they can see spirits everywhere. But just because you cannot see doesn't mean they don't exist. Okay, now, the Shambhala is a place that agriculture is very easy. Living is more easy. Health has no problems. Life is very, very long. And the place is governed and ruled by good ethics and good human ethics. And so what happens is, when we practice the Kala Chakra teachings, we create an affinity that when we die, we can be reborn in a place called Shambhala. When we're reborn in a place called Shambhala, the Shambhala place is a place where they practice Dharma very strong, and the necessity to practice Dharma is very easy. Example, getting food, house, teachings, health, long life, All these problems are not a problem in this place. So when we go there, when we reincarnate there, it's very easy for us to practice Dharma and attain the results. Somewhere the kings of Shambhala are considered emanations of Manjushri. The kings of Shambhala, the first king, actually, the kings of Shambhala actually, during Buddha's time, actually traveled from their kingdom to Lord Buddha to receive the teachings of Kalachakra. And they brought the teachings back to Shambhala and practiced it. And this king became a Bodhisattva king, where he taught his subjects the Kalachakra teachings. And when he taught the Kalachakra teachings, Buddha's teachings, many people in his society became very highly advanced. So this king passed it to his son, to his son, to his son. Until now, I don't know the number of kings now, I think 21st or 21st king, something like that, were in the reign of the 21st king. In that kingdom, where the kings still are the teachers of the people, they practice Dharma, they have enlightened rule. So when we practice the Kalachakra teachings, we develop a very strong and special affinity to be reborn in that place. Now the difference is this, that Shambhala place is a place existing on this earth. And it is said to reside somewhere in the Himalayas. It is not Tibet. It is said to reside somewhere in the Himalayas, that if we have karmic affinity, when we go there, we can find it. Therefore, from Shambhala comes the word Shangri-La. Shangri-La means a place where there's no suffering, it doesn't get old, there's no treachery, the people there are nice, and it's in the Himalayan mountains. In fact, Western Hollywood has made movies about Journey to Shangri-La, where they go there, people are very nice, and it's ruled by a high lama. We've heard that. That legend is based on Shambhala teachings. Alright, that's one. There are some high lamas who, when they die, they reincarnate there and they reside there. And when the time is right, they again emanate out and reincarnate other places to teach. So what happens is, His Holiness Dalai Lama gives the Kalachakra teachings all over the world, maybe once or twice a year, all over to hundreds of thousands of people. Why? To make them connect to this kingdom, to bless them. That's one. Okay, the outer kingdom of Shambhala is this place that we can take rebirth in if we make a karmic connection by God of practice. That's one. Number two. If we change our mind, everywhere we live becomes a Shambhala. Why? Difficulties, we say thank you. Happiness, we don't become attached. And we always abide in a mind of non-treachery, of kindness, and thinking about the other person first, and giving advice that's beneficial, and using our lives to benefit others on many levels. A person who has those qualities, we say that they have the inner Shambhala. So the inner Shambhala represents the outer Shambhala, because the outer Shambhala is a place without treachery, without unhappiness, without foolish people. It's a place without that. So if you have Shambhala in you, it means you are a person without those negative qualities. So when we practice the Dharma, it represents to achieve that type of state where we are and not to wait to be born over there to achieve it. That's one. Understand? Number two is His Eminence Chödyam Trungpa Rinpoche was a special holder and practitioner of the Shambhala teachings, according to what I read. And therefore, he propagated the teachings of Shambhala and to take rebirth there. But he was more concerned not for people to die to take rebirth in Shambhala. He was more interested in people creating Shambhala in their mind now. So when he did calligraphy, the ash symbol and how he wrote it and how he drew it, when we see it, it reminds us of Shambhala and to develop the Shambhala in us. That's what it means. Okay?
So the suggestion is we have to remind them of Shambhala.
If you know the meaning of Shambhala, then when you see that, it reminds you. Example. When you see your house key, does it remind you of your house? Do you know everything inside?
Yeah.
You know how many rooms you have, what you have inside a room, what you have, it's just a key. But if you show me your house key, will I know what's in your house? Will I know?
Of
course not. But because you know your house, when you see the key, it symbolizes what's inside. So if you know the Dharma, if you see that stroke, you will know what that represents, and it reminds you. Okay? One. Number two. Because that stroke represents enlightened mind, when we see that calligraphy or that stroke, it isn't just symbolism to remember something, it also plants a seed in our mind to achieve it. So it's enlightened calligraphy. There's a difference.
For someone who actually to see the calligraphy, they should get reminded, it doesn't know we can.
A person who understands the Dharma gets reminded to practice. A person who doesn't understand gets a seed planted in their mind for the future to practice. Subliminal messaging. Subliminal. Why? Because the character doesn't represent just some normal human symbol. It represents a state of the enlightened mind. Shambhala. Okay? That's why, Yes, that's why when we wear Buddha pendants on us, when we wear Buddha pendants, the Buddha represents everything we want to achieve. So when we wear it, it's very powerful, it raises the body. It symbolizes that. So every time we see the Buddha pendant, every time we wear the Buddha pendant, it reminds us of things we shouldn't do and things we should do. So by wearing it every day, it's a constant reminder of what we should do and not do. And at the same time, because it's a Buddha, it blesses us to help us to do the right thing. Same thing. Why? The Buddha pendant is Buddha in physical form. The chakra is Buddha in written form. Both is Buddha. But for modern people, because you're not from Tibet or India or Nepal, where if they wear chakras all that, it's very normal. Here you hear people dress very beautifully. And they're very beautiful, very clean. So all of a sudden you have a big claw and some chakra, and quite messy, and maybe if it gets wet and smelly, people will have misunderstanding. So what happens is, being here, I created pendants for people. Why? It will match them better here. If I was in Tibet, I wouldn't have to create that. Chakras would be fine. But at the same time, chakras still can be carried in the water, in the purse, in our house, or giving us protection. It's very, very powerful. It's Buddha's body symbolism written in words. No. One is Buddha's left arm. One is Buddha's right arm. Which one is more powerful? It's equal. It's just according to your need. So if you're in Tibet, you don't wash, you don't clean, you take a bath once a year, so if you put another string, another piece of paper hanging on your neck, it's okay, right? But in Malaysia, you're very clean and you wash. To have pieces of paper and all that hanging around your neck, don't you think it looks odd? So wouldn't it be better in Malaysia to have Buddha symbolism in physical form where you wear? You understand? You have to get out of the mind frame which one is more powerful. It's equal. Depends on what you need. You understand that? Listen carefully first. Relax. Get out of the mind frame. Which one is more powerful? Think they're both the same, but which one is more suitable for here? So in Tibet, chakras are very suitable. But here, it might not be suitable for some people. For example, when we go to the palace temple, they give you a food. You want to stick that in your body and walk all over the place? I mean, it's not bad, but it's difficult, isn't it? Maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago in China, they give you a food, you stick it here, everybody says it's okay. But here, if you pick a food and stick it around and walk around, they say, oh, this one, superstitious one. You understand? So what happens is this. If I give you Buddha's symbol, or Buddha's Dharma text, or Buddha's whatever, all the time, and you have to carry it, it's heavy, it's bulky, why don't I just convert that into a pendant of Buddha's body that represents the teachings? So when you carry that, it becomes your protection, it also becomes a reminder, and it also becomes a blessing. So this will be more suitable here in Malaysia. So in Tibet, people do wear pendants, but they're made from clay. They're called sasas. You've seen, right? They're made from clay, they're quite bulky. It's not convenient for people to carry. Because here, the weather is very hot, and people wear very little clothes to keep cool. But in Tibet, you wear layers and layers and layers of clothes. So when they have a sasa, they also have a gaul, you get my kawuk upstairs. You know my bedroom where I sleep above, there's a kawuk in silk. Mm-hmm. It's covered, right? We bring that one here. So people wear that, but under layers of clothes, how can we wear it here? So I reduce the kawuk to something of precious metal. Why? You wash, you clean, you sleep, you drop, you put here, there, it doesn't get destroyed. It's more convenient. So what I'm doing here is exactly what they do in Tibet, but in more current, applicable situations here.
Yeah, because my friend, I want to
So what are you going to give them? Chakra pendant? Why?
No, pendant looks like they will wear chakra, I can tell them to wear.
Very good. But, if you know how to explain the pendant, and you give it to them on a very special occasion, they'll be very touched, they'll wear it for that to be meaningful. Like an anniversary, like a birthday, and you give them a very beautiful explanation, and you talk well, and it's with love, they'll wear it. Why a lot of people wear pendants and stuff given to them by their father, by their husbands, by their wives, whatever they wear. Not because they want it, but it symbolizes something.
But because the chakra, or the chakra is quite interesting and quite colorful, right? So because the pendant is a pendant, you know, if you look at them as well, and then probably they won't find it so fascinating. But where else the chakra is colorful, then I can
make a crystal. For me, I find the pendant much more interesting. I'd rather wear a pendant than a chakra. For me. That's my personal. And I've worked with them since I was very young. Very, very young.
Yeah, because
for
me, you only have to have affinity with your, but those, they are totally ignorant.
Very true.
So what I thought is, what I was thinking is like, colorful chakra with the colorful crystals.
Well, you see, what you can do is this. You can educate them. You can make the pendants very beautiful with jewelry, so it looks like jewelry. This is a sansa. This is the tamsa. And this one has a precious item, and this is called a bau. Okay? And what happens is this is when we travel. I think Dharma talks, turn your phone off if you don't mind. 2-3 hours can, right? Do you have any emergency at home? No, is there any emergency? Then you go and talk quickly. I like to talk here, we cannot hear Basara, you cannot hear you, what's the point? Go talk quickly. But during Dharma talk, maybe turn off 2-3 hours, keep for yourself. Yeah. Don't mind none.
Can they actually carry?
Yes. Some they carry bigger ones. So what happens is this, you see each gaul, a traditional one, has arms. Right? So you tie a rope or a string and you carry it like
that. I think they have these KP but the tiny ones.
Yes.
With a silver. Yes. Nine.
So what we do now in Malaysia is, I don't think anybody can carry this, but two things can happen. You can carry this around you when you travel, so it becomes your travel altar. How beautiful. Or you, some of us, we have very small altars. We live in a small place. This would be very good to keep in our house. So what happens is, it's very safe and very beautiful. We should make it out of the most precious items. Silver, put precious jewelry, and then we place the precious item inside, and then inside. Inside, and we can put a lot of chakras, we can put our guru's clothes or hair, we can put prayers, mantras, we can also fill it with other precious items we have, so it becomes a charm also. It's very beautiful. Very, very beautiful. So we put mani pills, and then we clean it, and we make it as beautiful as possible. And then we offer cloth on it, if possible. Some like it like this, but I don't like this. So we offer clothes on it. Why? On a tanka, we offer clothes by sewing it. On a deity, we offer clothes on it directly. On this one, we offer right now. Okay, everything?
Yeah.
I think out of compassion for yourself and us, maybe turn off now. Okay? Out of compassion. 2-3 hours, Ken, I think the world will still be alright without you. 2-3 hours. After that, you can turn on the call. I know you're very busy. So this is what we call, this is called a gao. G-A-O. Gao. And the inside object, we call it tata. It's not the name of the deity, it's the name of the form of the statue. The statue is made usually from clay. But in Malaysia, I developed to make from resin, because it's more durable. So this particular form of the statue is called a tsatsa, T-S-A-T-S-A. So it's easy to carry, it's convenient, it's small, it's holy, it's very nice. And in our lifetime, if we can, now listen very carefully, we should make 100,000 Buddha statues. Why? Making 100,000 Buddha statues minimum purifies a lot of negative karma we've collected with our body in previous lives and this life. It helps us to attain the Buddha body, and it helps us to collect a lot of merit to become a Buddha. So one of the preliminary practices is to make 100,000 statues. Think, oh my God, where do I put that? Distribute to people. Deal with it.
Okay.
Can I finish? Let me finish. I'll explain everything to you. So we should make 100,000. If we are Bill Gates, as big as possible. If you're Tamar Ritchie, you make tsatsas. Because you can't afford these statues. Does the statues all have to be the same deity? No. Does the statues all have to be the same size? No. Does the statues all have to be the same quality? No. You do it on your part. So maybe this year you can make 1,000 tsatsas to give away to people. Maybe 2 years from now you can make 100 big statues to give away to people. Maybe 5 years from now you can make 1,000 very big statues to give away to people. Slowly. Example, when we went to London last year, we offered 3,000 Manjushri statues to all the monks. I wasn't able to do that before. But about 5 years ago, I made 1,500 separate tsatsas to offer to the monastery. So at that time, I was able to only do tsatsas. Last year, I was able to do statues. This year and next year, I hope to offer 3,000 Lama Tsongkhapa statues to each monk. Why? We are normal people. If we make offerings to the monk and create statues, it benefits us tremendously. So for each one of us in this room, we should make 100,000 statues in our lifetime. If we die before we accomplish that, can this be your next one? Who keeps track? Karma. So what happens is, what do we do with this? In Tibet, what they do with the tsatsas is this, is that it's kind of hard to find 100,000 people to give away their tsatsas. So they build stupas. Sitting. Stupas?
Salita.
Yes. So that's why we're going to have a retreat center, where we build outdoor 6 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet, 10 feet stupas, and all of us can put our tsatsas inside. And so if one stupa has 200,000 or 300,000 tsatsas, imagine when someone circumambulates around the place, how much it benefits that person. Even the animals. That's why I want a retreat place, because our retreat place will be a total place for people to collect merit. Everything about a retreat place is collect merit. Everything. So that's one of the reasons I want to have a retreat place is we can do more practice. So someone like Anna, who's modern, who's busy, who has work, you can still be very spiritual through Dharma practice, but you don't have to be a nun. You can, one way you can make a lot of tsatsas, put it up there, sponsor a stupa. Why not? We don't have to have one, we can have two or three. We have a garden of stupas, like we saw in Nepal, Phong, remember? We can do that. Why? It benefits us. It benefits others. Even the animals who go around in the stupa, it helps them to take the burden of nature. Even the animals. And inside the stupa, we not only put tsatsas, we put many mantras, and we can put hundreds and hundreds of rock bases. How powerful. Just how powerful. The Chinese believe very much to sponsor prayer things. Yes. Why? You know why. So if you sponsor all these prayer things, where do you put it? You don't have enough friends to take them to. The temple is already too many statues inside stupa. Do you know why? It comes from the Chinese Buddhist heritage. Remember, Buddhism went to China before Tibet. So my point is what? The Chinese people have a very strong Buddhist cultural imprint. That's for sure. That's how we get along very well. That's right. So, to teach Dharma to Eastern people is easier in some ways because of that shared cultural background. Even the beautiful Malay people of this country are not Buddhist, but they understand the concept because they're in Asia, so we have the freedom to do Buddhist. person, even in this country. There's that shared common background. Yes, I agree with you. So my point is, what deity we create is up to us. And does it have to be the same one? No. What size? Up to us. So maybe this year you do 1,000 satsas. Next year, it could be 10 statues or 15 statues or 100 statues. You don't. But you should aspire to do more and more and more. Why? Aspiring to do more combined with doing something now creates the karma to do more in the future. Aspiring to do combined with doing something creates something. Simply aspiring and not doing anything will take much longer to accomplish. Much longer to accomplish. So therefore, we aspire to benefit many people and ourselves. We have to start with a few people around us. If we don't even start and be patient with a few people around us, don't say, well, why Buddhism have no result? It has result, but you're not pushing yourself toward getting the result. So, for example, if we can't even get along with people in our family or in our cell group or in work, if we can't even push ourselves to get along with them, how are we going to become a better person? We say we want to be a better person. We have to start somewhere. Start somewhere. And that starts with respect for the people around us, cooperation, and awareness. Awareness. It starts somewhere. So therefore, you don't tell your guru, give me instructions, teach me Dharma, but you yourself don't want to apply to the dharmas that he give you that's difficult for you. Why is it difficult? Because you didn't do it. So if you don't do it because it's difficult, when a certain situation comes up, you will lose faith and confidence. Why? Because you never did it to overcome to reach the next level. If you don't overcome and reach the next level, when some other talk or gossip or situation comes, you lose faith. Why do you lose faith? Because you never push yourself to do something. That's why people lose faith very fast. Because they don't push. They don't trust themselves. They don't trust the teacher. In the end, they don't do anything. When they don't do anything, anything comes, I want to give up. I've heard this many times. Why do they want to give up? Because they haven't reached that level. Why haven't they reached that level? They don't trust themselves. They don't trust their teacher. They don't push themselves. So it's text 22. Everybody understand that? Okay. So the Shambhala set of teachings is particularly related to the Kala Chakra deity and the Kala Chakra cycle of teachings. The Kala Chakra is Buddha's direct emanation of a temporal deity that has a set of meditations that help us again to transform our passions into higher thoughts and to gain control of our vibhuti. Yes, it really is. Example, the master lineage holder of the Kala Chakra teachings today is his focus, Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, if you read his previous books from his previous life, has full control over when he's going to die and what's going to happen and where he will take it. Full control. This one is not one or two people, it's understood. When the Dalai Lama's new incarnation is enthroned by the government of Tibet and he's strictly tested, he's tested with things from his previous life. Matched together with things that are similar, and a young child must pick out from memory what was his that belonged to him. That's one testing needs to go through. Another test is they need to consult the oracles and high lamas who do divination separately, and their divination must match the exact same word without knowing what the other lamas that tested. And finally, the oracles themselves consulted. The Dharma protectors of Tibet will enter a medium, the biggest one, and will identify the word clean. So all these three things must match. When these three things match, it confirms that this is the real reincarnation of the dead person. They are enthroned. Once they're enthroned, they're put in for special training. Excel quick speed training to continue the work in their previous life. That's right. And the Dalai Lama is one example of highly attained practitioners. There are many, not only in Tibet. It's impossible, it's only in Tibet. Impossible. And not only on this planet. Okay? So that should help you on the Shambhala set of teachings. Questions?
The person who reincarnated themselves to be a Svetama and is not supposed to do a training to cause a total disease according to the books. So they said that you're not
if you have a balloon and you put a little bit of water in it, it's all right. If you fill it up, it's all right. But if you keep pumping water into the balloon, what happens? Like that, certain people have very strong aptitude to do something in their life. When they cannot do it, they become depressed. Because why? The karma is like flowing into their balloon. It's about to burst. When it bursts, they become depressed, or unhappy, or sick. So that's for everyone. Now, for a teacher who has died and who has made many prayers that he or she may spread the Dharma and spread the Dharma and spread the Dharma, what happens is when they reincarnate and outer situations stop them, because their karma to benefit others is so much, they cannot be forced to do other types of work. They cannot be forced to go to school, or to get married, or to have new business, or to have fun, or just waste their time. Why? It's like the bubble bursting. When they do that, they can become very sick, or not well, or not succeed, or can even die. Why? They will take another rebirth to do what they're supposed to do. So a tukul disease is not a disease that is like a sickness. It is actually, they don't have the right translation. What it is actually not them. There is no translation in English. What it is the tukul cannot manifest what they're supposed to do. So they show the signs of displeasure. So when you have a true reincarnation, if you don't put them in the training of Dharma, or they don't do Dharma work, they become depressed, they become suicidal, they want to kill themselves, they want to die, they have accidents, they become sick. High Lamas, a sign of them being high is, listen carefully, when they're not doing Dharma work, they're very depressed, they become anxious, they become sad, they want to commit suicide, they want to run away, and they're not settled. You can give them everything they want, but if they cannot do Dharma work, their mind cannot settle. Why? Because the karma to do it is very strong. So when you give them Dharma work, it's like you have the balloon and you put a few holes with a pin, the water can come out. So it doesn't burst. You put more and more in, it doesn't burst. Why? Everybody gets some water. So if you observe high lamas, how do you know they're high? If you give them cars, houses, money, sponsorship, buildings, you give them nice clothes, you give them all that, they don't become happy. They say, okay, thank you. They don't become happy. But if you create centers, you create temples, you create statues, you give them sponsorship to help the poor, you give them material items, you produce books to help many people, they become very happy. Why? They came to the world to do that. So why is that a sign of a high lama? Only higher beings think of doing things that benefit many people. Lower beings think of things that benefit themselves. So if you're a lower being, then if you give them cars and money and house, they're very happy. Why? They only think about themselves. But if they're a higher being, you may give them everything that makes us happy, but they won't be happy because that's not what they want. So therefore, if you create many Dharma centers, if you create a lot of statues, if you create a lot of teachings and texts, and people are organized, and they have help, and letters, and everything helping them to promote the Dharma, they'll be very happy. You will never hear them complaining, wanting to die, or run away, or nothing. Why? They came to do what they're supposed to do. It's very simple. So a tukul disease is a reincarnation of a lama who the outer circumstances don't allow them to manifest spreading the Dharma. So they become sick. Some in Tibet actually die. But a few years later, their reincarnation in another place.
So you experience that in America?
Sorry?
You also experienced anything in America?
I don't know if it was a tukul disease, but I was very unhappy because I couldn't do the Dharma class for sure.
So you ran away?
I tried to commit suicide twice. I ran away 3 times. And I stayed away. Yes, that happened to me exactly.
So what happened to the child? Is similar to what happened to you?
May I humbly say similar, yes. Similar. A real tukul will be very happy doing Dharma work, no matter how difficult, no matter how late they need to stay up, no matter how sick they become, no matter how much burden and trouble they have, as long as they do Dharma work, they'll be very happy. A faithful fool is one that when they have to endure difficulties for the Dharma, they become unhappy. Like me. Oh yes, a faithful fool will be very unhappy to deal with Dharma problems and obstacles. But a real fool, as long as the Dharma is flourishing, they will be very happy. Very, very happy. Why? Why is that a sign of a real fool? That's what they came to the world to do. So if they do what they came to do, of course they're very happy. Mozart came to the world to play piano. He was very happy. Even at a young age, a child prodigy, correct?
Yes.
Nobody taught him. If he didn't let him play, maybe he would be very depressed. But I would like to do more than just play pianos. I would like to come to the world for a higher reason than play pianos. No offense intended. So therefore, a tupu disease is a manifestation that person is not able to fulfill. And some tupus will die early. If their Dharma work doesn't grow, if their students don't perform, if their students don't push, they will die early. Why? They cannot do what they're supposed to do. So who loses out? Many people who could have gotten their benefit and didn't lose. Very simple. So how do we extend a tupu's life? How do we make our lama's life long? By transforming ourselves, by doing Dharma work, by making the Dharma grow, by benefiting others through Dharma. If the tupu's life or the lama's life will grow, very strong. And the life will be extended. It's very logical. Why? He can do what he's supposed to do. So there's a reason to live longer. If he cannot do what he's supposed to do, if every time the students are fighting, don't get along, don't listen to his advice, don't follow, or put a lot of unnecessary burdens, he will die early. Why would he die early? He goes to another place where people are ready. Maybe the people at this place only have this level that he can bring them to, so he goes to another place. Give me many factors. So how do we make a tupu or a lama's life long? How? By practicing Dharma. How do we practice Dharma? We transform. How do we transform? By not giving up. How do we not give up? By having great compassion for others. How do we have great compassion for others? To realize that they and us, there's no difference. We all want happiness. Very simple. And yet, very deep. Okay? Questions?
What is a kalapa
asati? I can't hear you.
Kalapa asati.
Students, maybe in all shopping. And how is it specific to the what? The Bao, the Dharma, or what is trying to do?
What is sexual misconduct? If you don't know, how do you know a country people Bao? You have to understand the Bao first. What is sexual misconduct? No, don't say Henry, I'm asking you. What is sexual misconduct?
Stupid, people who are my wife.
Not your partner. And it damages them. So if your partner knows or is accepted, is that sexual misconduct? Sorry? I'm asking you, by logic. A Muslim man has four wives. If he sleeps with one of his wives, is it sexual misconduct?
No.
Why?
Okay. So as
long as Why?
Because the other old woman and me.
They accept it. Okay. Then it's okay. So it's only sexual misconduct if someone is hurt. So if you have a wife that says you can sleep with other women, I sleep with other men because it will be better for our relationship in the long run because we love each other, then it's not sexual misconduct. But if you're with a wife that knows you're sleeping with other women and it hurts them, it's sexual misconduct. You will be born as an animal.
But she was hurt at the beginning, right?
She was not hurt at all. He told her in the beginning already, and she sleeps with other men. One of her sons belongs to one of the other men. If you read, she was not hurt.
She asked me,
Yes. And when she had the son by that other man, really she cherished the son because it was hers. You see, in Tibet, women are allowed to have 3, 4, 5 husbands. Which for good women, it's very helpful for agriculture and keeping the wealth. For bad women, they take birth as an animal. So you don't look at sleeping with 3, 4 men as good or bad. It's your motivation. It's your motivation. So if you, your wife knows you're sleeping around and she accepts it, it's not sexual misconduct. It's maybe you need it more, she cannot provide. So because of that, maybe it makes your relationship with her deteriorate and affect the children in the long run in a bigger way. But if she doesn't agree and you sleep around, it's sexual misconduct, whether you have the vow or not. Some people think, oh, I don't have the vow, so I'm not breaking it. Wrong. You're breaking ethical vows. It's already bad karma because someone's hurt. Someone is hurt or not is not dependent on whether you have the vow or not. Somebody's hurt because you've hurt them. So even if you don't have the vow, you say, oh, I'm okay, I don't have the refuge vow, I can sleep around. Stupid. So that means if you don't have the refuge vow, you can kill? No. Definitely not. Definitely not. Why? It's on the basis of hurting. So then you say there's no difference. Why take a vow? Because if you take a vow and you avoid, you collect the merits to overcome the habituation to do it. Because you swore to the Buddha and your Guru, I will not do that from now on. And since I will not do that from now on, every day you don't live it, even though you're itchy and you have difficulties to resist, then your karma will build up that you can overcome.
Why?
Merit.
Why didn't you do it?
Sorry?
Why didn't you do it? So is that?
This one you're going to have to ask him. Him sleeping with other women affected what? Did it destroy his dharma work?
No.
Did it destroy him? His incarnation's in Tibet. You guys got the picture I sent by MMS, right? His incarnation now is in Tibet. You sleep with many other women, you probably incarnate in Tibet as a yak. He sleep with other women, he reincarnate in Tibet as another human being. Him sleeping with other women has nothing to do. Sometimes, I'm not talking for me, sometimes he even benefits those women. Sometimes. Not for people like us, of course. That's one. Second thing is, how did it affect his work? He's a layman, he's not a monk. Sleeping with women is like eating or sleeping or taking medication. It's maintaining your body. It's a physiological need. If you go overboard, it's very dangerous. But if you take it like eating and sleeping, it's the same thing. Men create sperm. Sperm needs to be released. The most well-known way to release sperm is by sexual contact. Some men produce more sperm, some produce less. There are different types. But my point is what? It's like eating. Men get hungry. It's like sleeping. Men get tired. But if you sleep all day, next day, every day, every day, and you don't take care of your responsibility, take care of your wife, it's very bad karma. Then sleeping becomes bad karma. If you don't care about anybody, and you just eat, or waste your money on alcohol, very bad karma. Why? Because you're wasting your body, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your money. So everything becomes the same. Sleeping, eating, drinking, entertainment, all becomes the same. But how bad it is whether it damages another person. So actually sexual intercourse is something like overeating, or oversleeping, or overextending, or shopping, or drinking alcohol. Why? It's indulging the senses. So in Buddhism, we don't say you don't sleep with people. Buddha explains how to do it to satisfy your need in a balanced way, but at the same time, not create damage. Why? He knows that most of the world cannot resist sleeping with people. He knows that. He knows that everybody needs to eat and sleep and also have sexual intercourse. He knows that. But he teaches you in such a way that it protects you while you're doing it. That's how kind the Buddha is. So especially in Tantric Vajrayana Buddhism, what is most important is they don't tell you don't have sex. What they tell you is how to do it in such a way doesn't create harm. That's why in Vajrayana Buddhism, outer appearance of how the Lama looks or acts is not so important, it's more internal. Why? The level is much higher. Much, much higher. So Rinpoche sleeps with women, he benefits them, he fulfills a physical need, but it didn't disturb his work, it didn't disturb his wisdom, it didn't disturb his power. His dharma growing, even after he's dead, it's growing and growing and growing. But we sleep with women, nothing grows. Nothing. In fact, we get older, we lose respect, we lose money, we lose time, nothing grows. So, how can we see the difference? Rinpoche speaks to women to see what he's done. We sleep with women, how can we get nothing? But the sleeping is the same, it's the motivation. Some more, his wife fully agreed. He told her from the first day, when they got married, she said to him, you know, you're the most important person in my life. He says, well, you're the second most important thing in my life. And she said, why? He says, Dharma is not number one. He already told her clearly. And he already told her openly, we're going to have an open relationship. You'll be more healthy for the future for everyone. More healthy. Now, to you, you may think, oh, that's your culture. But from Tibetan culture, it's not. It's not a problem. Sexuality in Tibetan culture is like in Chinese culture. You don't talk about it, you don't show it, you don't be so open, but it's more free. People have more sexual freedom. Like one woman having 3-4 wives or 3-4 partners in Chinese is very bad. But in Tibetan, they don't think anything. Why? They come from a Buddhist point of view, as long as no one's hurt. That's why there are many women in Tibet now have 2, 3, 4 husbands living together with them. Yes? Now, 3 brothers will marry 1 wife, and they'll live in the same house. And when she has a child, it belongs to all of them. DNA is same. No conflict. I have a monk student in London. He has 2 fathers. Both brothers married 1 woman. To you, that may seem foreign, but to them, your style is foreign. And in Chinese history, many men have 1 wife, but if they're successful, they have many wives. What's right? What's wrong? It's an excuse to express lust.
And what if this wife was so angry, kicked the husband out? Can the husband say that because of your kicking out?
It doesn't matter what the husband and wife says. You do what you feel is correct as long as it doesn't hurt, that's all. If it hurts them but you didn't want to hurt them, that's not your fault, is it? So you don't ask small things. You ask the big question that solves all the small things. You understand? So, if you buy a cup from this store and it's got a crack and it's green color, they're not even talking to you about the green drink. I'll just say, well, if that store looks like they have crack cups, don't buy from there. Yeah. Don't talk about each cup. Questions that relate to what we're reading.
Coming back to this dukkha disease, which I was reading.
Coming to what, sorry?
Coming back to the dukkha disease, Rinpoche knows that begging is a guru, and yet he refuses to allow him to go to the monastery for further teachings. That part of it, I can understand. Why is he going back? Is it because that he's attached to his son? I mean, he is a guru.
I think, and don't quote me on this because I don't understand his mind totally. I think it's because Rinpoche grew up in a very cluster, isolated, and very difficult training. And he felt that it would be difficult for his son who was experienced in America. You see, Rinpoche had no option. How Rinpoches are trained up is very glamorous on the outside. They're put on the throne, they're, you know, given seals, they wear hats, and people prostrate and donate to them. But actually, behind the scenes, the Rinpoche's training is brutal. It's very brutal. Some Rinpoches don't survive. It depends on their level. They're very brutal. They expect to be double compassionate to others, stay up longer, study more, understand more, do more retreats, be more kinder, and have better qualities than the next human being. So a Rinpoche in the monastery with another monk, the true training is much more brutal. So what happens is, what I feel is that Rinpoche felt compassion for Taki, feeling that knowing his family is in America, you know, everything's nice. If he sent him there, it would be too brutal and harsh. That's what I think. It couldn't be for any negative motives. And I think Rinpoche wanted to train him up himself. But Taki perhaps needed something else. Is that alright? It doesn't explain everything, but a little bit better. And Taki is a reincarnation. With respect, we don't know the level. We don't know the level. Because high levels will survive anywhere. Under any condition. I mean, it should be that way, right? So if the gold is high quality, whether you put it in the sun or put it in the fire, it still comes out as gold. If it's gold plated but inside is silver, if you put it in the sun, it's okay. You put it in the fire, it melts and the silver comes out. So if it's a high reincarnation, everywhere you put them in whatever situation, they will come out on the top. Why? They are trained for many lifetimes. So it's just second nature. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right? It's like an athlete who's in the prime of his body or her body. No matter what the condition is, they all excel. Not enough sleep. Maybe they go to a country that the training area is not very good, difficult. They'll still come out okay. Whereas an athlete that's not in top condition, if some of the situation is not right, maybe they fail. I mean, something like that. Questions, please? Is everybody okay on time? I'm all right. Actually, I had a very bad migraine. I've had only a few hours of sleep. I've been up 36 hours straight. I've had very little sleep, and I was quite in pain. But the minute I walk in here, everything's fine. I'm not kidding you. I'm not even imagining it. Maybe because my mind is focused on something else, not the pain. But then I did take some painkillers, so that might help too. Okay. It's combined with something. Not Sambala, Shambhala.
Shambhala.
Yeah, Shambhala. That's H.
Shambhala's teaching a Shambhala system when he actually named the wife as a princess.
Queen.
Queen. He's a king. And there's a Mr. Zuka. The whole purpose of this is to try to build a system to take over also, pretty all this thing is to, in case you die at night, because people still continue straight on.
That's a smaller reason, but there's a higher reason. That's your question?
Yeah.
Okay. This will be a little bit difficult for anyone to try on. In tantric practice, unlike other practices, we take the result onto the path. That means, before we become a Buddha, we imagine ourselves as a Buddha. Whereas in Hinayana paths, you do not imagine yourself as a Buddha, you actually practice in order to become a Buddha. But in Tantrayana practices, in Vajrayana practices, although you're not a Buddha, you imagine yourself to become Buddha in order to stop actions that are not Buddha-like. So you take the result onto the path. The path is what you're practicing the Dharma. The result is what the practice is Buddha. The result of your practice is Buddha. The path is the practice. So when you take the result onto the practice, you are accelerating it. And for modern people, they always say this, I am depressed. I don't have a purpose in life. I don't know who I am. I'm not confident of myself. So the Tantra teachings are very powerful to counter these types of negative emotions that actually bring us down. So what happens is, when we receive Kala Chakra teachings, in the Kala Chakra sadhana is quite big, we would actually go through the meditations and practices as if we are a Kala Chakra deity. And our wife, our husband, our children, around us are the ministers, are the entourage, are deities of the gate, the deities of the mandala. And also our house is not visualized as a house, it's visualized as a divine abode of Kala Chakra. Why? So that it cuts our attachment to ordinary appearance. Meaning, if we keep thinking it's my wife, it's my wife, it's my wife, we will yell, we will scream, we will be mean, we will cheat, we will lie, we will do all kinds of negative things. But if we think she's a consort of Kala Chakra, we dare not do that. But she's a Buddha. So what happens is, even if she's not a Buddha, if we think of her as a Buddha, it helps us to stop actions that are un-Buddha-like. That's one. So when His Eminence Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche called himself the Sakyong, holder of the earth, the king of the earth, he represents the Kala Chakra teachings on earth from the kingdom of Shambhala. Shambhala has many representatives of their kingdom throughout samsara. He is one of their representatives by virtue that he practices the teachings, so he brings people there. He's like an ambassador. In order for us to get a visa to enter Malaysia, we need to go to the embassy. In each country, the embassy or the ambassador represents the whole country. And he's very powerful. Therefore, we must respect. Therefore, that ambassador is kind of like the prime minister of Malaysia in that respected country. You understand? Okay, that's one. So when Rinpoche calls himself the Sakyong, and his wife is the Sakyong Wangmo, She is the queen, he is the king. The kids are his divine children. The assistants, all that, are deities of the mandala, and his house represents the divine abode. What he's trying to do is change people's view to always look at things in an ordinary way. When his wife thinks of herself as the queen of Shambhala, although she's not, she gains confidence to do something. She gains more confidence in who she is. It's like a rebirth. It's like when we give the refuge ceremony. When we give the refuge ceremony, and afterwards our Lama gives us a sign. Instead of committing to our Lama, we cannot, we should push ourselves to do it. Why? He's opening the potential in us. Similarly, when he names her the Sakyong Wangmo, the queen of Shambhala, he's opening up her potential to transmit and spread the Dharma to others. Although at that moment, she cannot, but by giving her that name, he's opening the potential for her to be able to do so in the future. So in their court, they have the doctrines, they have the ministers. In my place, I call them liaisons. It's just a different name. So when the liaisons fail, or don't want to do, or lazy, or don't push themselves, they destroy their own potential, they destroy the potential of their Lama. They say, well, then I won't want to be a liaison, I want to run away. Then you get even more damage. Why? You're giving a pot of gold, but you'd rather live in poverty. So that's why when you're giving positions in committees, you're giving positions in, especially in the Lajran, or work, or health, it helps you develop that potential. It's just different names. So therefore, him giving titles and names to people in his Kalpa court is him opening their potential to what they can be. Before they become it. It's like your son, who you want him to become a doctor, before he becomes a doctor, hey doctor, 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 keep reminding him. You understand? And also at the same time, it's a blessing. Because you're not naming them ordinary names. You're naming them names of deities. Names of divine beings. The second one, or the real one, is the queen consort of the king of Shambhala. She's not an ordinary lady. She's a woman. So Kalachakra has a consort. Whether we prostrate to him or to her, there's no difference. They're actually one being. They're one being. Their level is the same. And at the same time, what you say is correct. Is that when you give people these titles, they live up to these positions. After he's gone, they can carry on the teachings to say, well, I'm the liaison. Well, I'm the something one more. I'm the Dapen. I'm the Kusum. I'm this, I'm that. So I need to continue. So the Lamas give titles to people and letters to give them titles to help them to carry on the teachings after he's gone to prepare for the future. Alright. So people who are given titles should be hold on to them very strong and seriously. Very strong. And if you say, I'm not ready for it, that's when you are ready for it. Why? If you're not ready for it, and the Lama gives it to you, he's making you ready. Because if you do it on your own time, probably you'll never be ready. And a lot of time is wasted. So that's why titles given by Lamas, especially on their stationery, is very sacred. It's very holy. And you saw Rinpoche wrote a lot of letters. Titles and appointments. To some, it looked like a joke, but actually there's a very deep meaning behind it. Very deep. Okay? Questions? Yes?
Rinpoche heard of something about his people of the region being very aggressive.
Yeah.
Rinpoche. And he says, people on in this way, he heard of it a long time. And eventually, I think he's cannot stand anymore. And eventually, he's what? Trying to take drug with him. Eventually, write a letter for no, for him for no.
Yeah. Your question?
My question is, why would it take so long to do it?
Why did he take, who take so long to do what?
For Rinpoche to actually...
He's giving him a chance. He's giving him a chance, and the guy doesn't want to take a chance. He doesn't want to overcome his arrogance, his insecurity, and his fears to trust Rinpoche. So Rinpoche gave him a chance, because if he had let go and surrendered to Rinpoche and done it, he would have become the regent. That means even after Rinpoche is dead, he would have gone on teaching. And in fact, I feel if he had accepted Rinpoche's instructions, he would have lived a long life. He would have changed his mind. He's already dead. Rinpoche tries to avoid all of that. People don't know what Rinpoche is trying to do long term for the person. I think Rinpoche already knew what will happen to him in the future, how he will die, what will happen, everything he knows. So Ruchi was very fierce with him to stop what will happen, but the guy didn't stop. He's dead now, but everybody else is alive. He died at AIDS. I think Ruchi. So for people who have danger to their life, danger to them, Ruchi is very fierce to them. Very fierce. He banged the table until the table has a mark, and he shot very loud. He take the paint, he slapped her on everybody. People think that only some Rinchis do that. No, you're wrong. Why? The Rinchi is very compassionate to put his reputation on the line to help another person. Very compassionate. Very. People don't know that. People don't study. They will say, why, the question. Actually, they don't know. Rinchi is very compassionate.
So what do mean? The no mean? What is to mean or the word no?
Know to immediately what you're doing, and know to grasping on to things that don't exist. It's a dual meaning.
But no also means the Dharma, right?
No. Why would no mean the Dharma? No means no to non-Dharma. Questions? Sorry?
Most people see it, you can see someone else lying in the future.
Most Rinpoche can see someone else's life in the future. Some can. But they won't tell you.
They'll give you.
Sorry?
They will give you hints.
They can give you hints, or some Rinpoches cannot see into the future, but they know the Dharma text very well. They know that if you do this, the result will be this. So they can watch what you're doing, they can tell you what the result will be. Also, so it looks like they're clairvoyants, but not necessarily. So it can come from study or powers, either way. But the function of the Rinpoche is to help you. To help you avoid. Exactly. Questions? About the potential that Diana has. It's not saying she's Vajradhini, so I don't understand. What it's talking about is the grand lady of the realm. The grand lady of the realm represents what? The realm represents the realm of enlightenment, or Shambhala. The lady of the razor's knife. The razor's knife is the knife that Vajradhini holds. That knife cuts everything that stops you from going to that realm. Okay? So when he's praising her combined with what she can become if she applies herself to the Dharma practice. So it's a dual type of poem theory. So it's like saying, Annette, you are an intelligent lady who likes to study the Dharma. That's about you right now. If you study the Dharma, you become the grand lady that flies in the sky. But you can't fly in the sky right now because you're not Buddha. But you can become that if you study the Dharma. Then I go back to to the next line. Annette, the lady who lives in luxury and ease and comfort because of your previous life's prayers, you have money, food, and house easy. With that, may you become the grand lady that provides that for many beings in the future. So you cannot do that now for everybody, but you have that now, but I'm asking you what you enjoy now to multiply that so you can help many people in the future. So it's a praise to what you are and what you can become. It's a beautiful place on the teams. Understand that? So when we have poems, Buddhistic poems, it is to bring out the potential in us. So it's not necessarily that you are Buddha or you are Vajradhini, it means you can become. So when they relate it to a certain deity, it means that by this deity's practice, by this deity's path and meditation, you can reach that level because you have some affinity. So we need that also. So in this poem, if he's talking about Vajradhini in relation to her, it means that she has some special relationship with Vajradhini, that if she practices, she can attain all these incredible states. That is describing. And in their lineage, their main practice is Vajradhini. Yes. So Vajradhini is something that's very, very widespread and powerful. But they don't talk about it because it's very secret. Yes, very good.
Because I want to read that last time. not
yes, Juan is correct. I'm very happy you talked to Juan because she's a very knowledgeable lady. And what I want to say is in Tibet, olden times, even the picture and the statue of Akhi can appear very similar. Why? It's a naked lady.
Because you know why? I took one in my phone and then I say I don't have to see. So I say, but I didn't have it.
Of course you did.
Because you know,
in Tibet, there are many people who have a lower level mind. When they see Bhagavad, they get shocked. They don't understand why. Why is it naked baby? Why like that? Why like that? They don't understand. They don't understand the meaning. So you keep a cover, not that something's wrong, to protect their mind. Example, if a husband and wife is in the bedroom doing their thing, do you open the door for your child to see? Is there something wrong with what you're doing?
No.
But why do you hide it from the child? They don't understand yet. That's all. That's right. Same thing with Bhagavad. Same thing. It's out of compassion you cover it, not out of fear. Not because you're doing something wrong. She's a Buddha. The first time I brought Vajrayani home to my stepmother is a picture. I was very, very young. 11 or 12. The first time I got it from one of my Dharma friends in America. It's a 5R size Vajrayani. When I showed my mother, she threw it down. Yes. She said to me, don't keep it. It's a weird Tibetan god. It's not a Buddha, but she's Buddhist. She's not a Buddha, cannot be Buddha, not like that. Don't keep it now, don't keep it here, it's not good. Take it out. And she was very scared. And she said that to me to protect her, but she doesn't know anything. So what I did is I keep that. I told my friends, they said, oh, you shouldn't show your mother. I said, why? They said, her level is not there yet. It's not she's bad, she doesn't understand. I said, if she says like that, is it bad for her? They said, no, of course it would come. Logic needs very compassionate. So I kept it always away, and secretly away. Then later I talked to my mother again, and again I explained, again. Later, she didn't pray, but she said, okay, you can keep it. She understood. So later, I kept it open. When she was in the good mood, when she was in the bad mood, I just put her away. Yeah, all my statues and pictures, because she didn't want me to pray. Good. Questions?